Question. In American history, how many of you were taught? How many of you were taught that all 13 colonies rebelled against King George III? How many of you were taught that in American history? In your American history, grammar school, high school, maybe even college, were we taught that all 13 colonies rebelled against King George III? Who here was not taught that? Where did you go to school, sister?
Iowa.
Oh. Public school in Iowa, but...
You know, I don't know if I was taught that or if I've learned through the years that not everybody was on board with the revolution. Right?
Not everybody was on board with the...
The rebellion.
With the rebellion. Okay. So even if you were taught it, you were never on board with it. I swallowed it like a fish breathes water. Been there, done that, got the t-shirt for it. I know what that's like. And that gives me the reason to say the following things. Greetings, kindred, fellow sheep, and neighbors. We are on a first name basis here. My name is Walter. Now, what you're going to hear in this message is something I originally prepared for our local patriot group. You're going to hear a message that is intended to encourage people to go back to the Bible, to find a real church. Patriot groups are a fertile field of evangelism. How do I know that? Because I got recruited into the church through the Patriot movement. And it was rife with deep state agents, provocateurs, people who steered you into false information to try to get you harvested. King David says in Psalms, we are counted all day as sheep for the slaughter. Matthew 10:16 reads, behold, I send you forth, Jesus speaking. Behold, I send you forth as sheep in the midst of wolves. The next part is our instruction. How to survive in wolf country. Be ye therefore wise as serpents and harmless as doves. I'm grateful to our elder, Howard Freeman, who did a series of lessons on that and took me through that and trained me. I am delighted to be with you. Your presence here indicates your interest in changing what will happen tomorrow. Our interest in changing what will happen tomorrow is unifying. It is the basis of our unity. Every one of our families forming our neighborhoods has a vested interest in avoiding what does not work. Every family that forms our neighborhoods has a vested interest in doing what does work. The head of each family household has a dominion. Each head of house is a judge in his own court. It is the original family court, the Magna Carta or Great Charter signed by King John, 1215, at sword point, provided no Englishman could be denied his own court. What works for one may not work for another. Each family's assignment in changing what will happen tomorrow will be unique to that family. For the truth of what I say, this basic maxim of English law pleads my cause. A man's house is his castle. Even the king must knock to enter. If culture cancels that puppy, there will be no door for Katie to bar. The reason we meet is to share stories about what worked and to share resources to enable family to complete their mission. Question. In a meeting of this kind, how do we discern between what works and what does not work? How do we choose the right? Any idea? Is the past a window into the future? Is past experience instructive to future decisions? Can we know where we are going if we have no idea where we have been? And we've already established most of us were lied to. Hear these words which appear in the oldest literature in Adam. For you, Ecclesiastes chapter 1, verses 9 and 10. I will not say that at the Patriot meeting. I've been bumped several times, so you're actually the first ones to hear this. We had some speakers of national reputation, and they did have some very important things to say. Some good news and good resources for us to survive in Wolf Country. Let's do these verses responsively. In church setting, I always like for fellow students in God's classroom to have a chance to recite the scriptures. So let me take verse 9, and classmates, would you follow along? And let me take verse 10. This is a responsive reading. I read first out of Ecclesiastes chapter 1, verse 9. The thing that hath been, it is that which shall be. And that which is done is that which shall be done. And there is no new thing under the sun. Is there anything whereof it may be said, see, this is new? It hath been already in ancient times, which was before us. Why do, quote-unquote, ancient times have something to do with us now? Is it because we have no idea where we are going if we have no idea where we've been? Do some people have a vested interest in robbing us of any idea where we are going? Do wolves pose as expert sheep herders? Would they be willing to lie to us about where we have been? Is carnal nature predictable? Would someone willing to rob us and our children of our past be enemies? Do enemies at war lie to each other? Warfare is never a comforting thought to our wives and children, nor even our grandchildren. My firm purpose is to avoid being hysterical. My firm purpose is to be historical. Can we focus on what works if we are robbed of our history? Who here remembers Joseph Sobran? Show of hands. Joseph Sobran. Pastor James? Anybody else? I heard he died in 2004. He was a syndicated columnist in the 1980s and 1990s. He frequently wrote about American history, especially about the Declaration of Independence, the Constitution, and the Bill of Rights. Both friend and foe accused him of being a constitutionalist. I'm always suspicious of isms, and the ists and istics who practice them. However, I'm willing to give you a hearing if you happen to be one of the ists or even one of the istics. I have learned something by doing that on occasion. I mention Joseph Sobran because he gave the best definition of education I've ever heard. Quote, "The purpose of education is to enable our children to continue conversation begun by our ancestors." Joseph Sobran, Post-Constitutional America, 1994, the address he gave, I believe it was to the Young Americans for Freedom in Washington, D.C., their annual convention. In the history of our nation, who here remembers James Gillespie Blaine? Some people know him as James G. Blaine. He was senator from Maine, where my relatives live who call themselves the Maniacs. He was senator from Maine and best friends with Senator James Abram Garfield from Ohio. To my knowledge, Garfield, America's 20th president, is the only preaching pastor elected to the nation's highest office. On July 2, 1881, James Gillespie Blaine accompanied his best friend Garfield to the Baltimore and Potomac train depot. President Garfield was scheduled aboard the train to begin a two-week vacation by joining his wife, Lucretia, at the Jersey Shore for the holiday. As the two friends moved to the train platform, an assassin shot Garfield in the back. Blaine recognized the shooter as a frustrated office seeker, pointed him out to the policeman on attendance. The whole country waited on his convalescence by daily reports. He breathed his last September 19th at 10:35 p.m. As America mourned his loss after only 200 days, his funeral was bigger than John Kennedy's in 1963. I mention James Gillespie Blaine because he is the author of a two-volume history entitled 20 Years of Congress from Lincoln to Garfield, published 1884. He is the composer of this quote, quote, America is the only nation on earth with a known birthday. How many of us were taught America was born in rebellion? How many of us were taught in history classes the English colonists rebelled against King George? Does the historical record support the claim that America's independence is the fruit of rebellion? How did America, the only nation on earth with a known birthday, come to be born? To understand the birth of America, must we understand how the colonies, the original 13 colonies, came into existence? Who here can tell us how the original 13 colonies came into existence? Anybody? I'm glad I asked the question. The answer is charters. Charters. C-H-A-R-T-E-R-S. What were these charters? The charters were contracts between proprietors and companies and the King of England. These were all accomplished by the authority and power of the throne. Parliament was never a party to these contracts or charters. All 13 charters granted the proprietors and companies legislative, executive, and judicial authority. The king retained only restraining authority, a form of veto power. David Ramsey, in his book, Prelude to the American Revolution 1765 to 1775, wrote about the colonial parties to the charters. Quote, they looked upon their charters as a voluntary compact between their sovereign and themselves, by which they were bound neither to be subject to nor seek protection from any other prince, nor to make any laws repugnant to those of England, but did not consider them as inferring an obligation of obedience to a parliament in which they were unrepresented. Not only were they unrepresented in parliament, Parliament itself was never a party to the contracts or charters. The 13 American colonies were 13 self-governing peoples. In an article entitled, quote, Development of Imperial Control, 1606 to 1760, unquote, Encyclopedia Britannica, 11th edition, volume 27, page 668, reported the Charter of Maryland granted to Lord Baltimore and his heirs contains this clause, quote, free, full, and absolute power, dot, 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 to ordain, make, and enact laws of what kind soever according to their sound discretion, unquote. Of the thousands of laws colonial legislatures enacted between 1691 and 1763, England's throne vetoed 5%. Why only up to 1763? 1763 marked the end of the French and Indian War. Great Britain had incurred a huge war debt. The colonists paid their own war expenses, and British soldiers were contemptuous of the soldier farmers. Rogers' Rangers became famous in that war. England decided the colonies needed to, quote-unquote, pay their fair share of Britain's war debt. You know, when you fight a war overseas, expenses go up. Parliament from 1763 to 1775 enacted legislation to control the colonial legislatures to raise monies to pay the war debts. The colonial legislatures considered themselves to be in allegiance to the king because he was their protector. They saw their legislatures as equal to Parliament. Parliament legislated for England, answerable to the king. Each colonial legislature legislated for its colony, answerable to the king. Parliament was no party to the charters. And the colonies had no representation in Parliament. That was the origin of the cry, quote-unquote, taxation without representation. Until 1775, the 13 colonies joined to make impassioned, godly appeals to the king on three grounds or causes. Three grounds or causes. Common kindred as Englishmen, number one. Number two, their loyalty as the king's subjects entitled to his majesty's protection. And number three, entitlement to their rights as Englishmen, which they had enjoyed prior to 1763. These godly appeals took the form of the Declaration of Rights of 1768 and the Declaration of Rights of 1774. The king and parliament answered each appeal with perverse provocations. In April 1775, British soldiers attempted to sneak out of Boston to confiscate the arms and ammunition of the lawful local colonial militias of Lexington and Concord. How many here were taught in grammar school that it was an attempted gun grab? The midnight rides of Paul Revere and William Dawes warned the militias, quote, the redcoats are coming, unquote. The redcoats had another secret mission, a second set of orders. These orders arose from intelligence reports that Samuel Adams and John Hancock would journey to Lexington. Quote, the shot heard round the world, unquote, began the war for independence. Upon that single shot, the redcoats fired a withering volley at the assembled Lexington minutemen, killing several and wounding many, and the standing order for the Lexington minutemen was, don't fire first. Is that some courage? A mortally wounded man managed to crawl to his house on Lexington Square and died in the arms of family. The militia dispersed. The redcoats stormed the houses to arrest Adams and Hancock, shackle them, and drag them back to army-occupied Boston. Since Adams and Hancock argued to stay and fight, cooler heads barely got them out before British troops breached the front doors. The British army regrouped and went on to Concord. They were stopped at the Concord Bridge by alarmed minutemen who, fighting Indian style, harassed and harried them all the way back to Boston, significantly reducing their ranks. The Redcoats raided houses on their retreat, killing men and women and the sick and the elderly in their chairs and beds, plundering food, money, and jewels. Do refusals to prosecute these crimes sound like our day? What about those arrest warrants on John Hancock and Samuel Adams? How did they honk off the king? John Hancock had made his fortune in shipping, international trade. He was using it to fund manly resistance to King and Parliament's depredations on the rights of Englishmen in America. Does that sound like Trump in our day? Is there anything new under the sun? The king had used his appointed governor of Massachusetts to bribe Samuel Adams to cease his efforts to unify all 13 colonies. Adams was the inspiration and driving force behind the committees of correspondence seeking to maintain and promote the unity of the 13 colonies which the French and Indian War had necessitated. Post-Revolutionary War history discovered Samuel Adams as the secret head of the Sons of Liberty, whose young horsemen maintained communications between all 13 committees. Does that sound like the first Pony Express? Adams exposed the king's secret offer and declared he would rather die than betray his native country of Massachusetts. The enraged king struggled mightily to grant Adams his wish. Does that sound like Roger Stone in our day? Roger Stone exposed to everyone who could get the news that his prosecutors offered him a bribe. If he would swear to testimony they composed, his troubles would melt away like snow on a sunny day. In a rage, Roger Stone declared he would never perjure himself before God and man for the Get Trump Gang. Prosecutors are officers of the court. The District of Columbia District Court judge immediately slapped Stone with a gag order. Was that order, the judge's confession, Roger Stone had nothing valid to confess toward his own conviction? Have law enforcement departments had an unfortunate history of beating confessions out of people rather than doing a proper investigation? Did it result in U.S. Supreme Court decision Miranda, U.S. versus Miranda? You got to tell them what their rights are. Whew. What a confession. If rights are responsibilities, what happened to us as a people that we needed United States versus Miranda? Miranda versus United States. He appealed. He was the plaintiff. Does that tell us a lot about what we've become? Samuel Adams spent more than a year of frustration urging the Continental Congress to face two facts. One, King George had fired upon Englishmen, his own subjects, and two, he was not protecting his subjects. He was dealing with them as enemies. He fired on French and Indian war veterans. To his colleagues in Congress, he cited Blackstone's commentaries on the laws of England showing the king's duty to protect his subjects and English subjects' duty of allegiance to their king for his protection. Failure on the part of one causes the duty of the other to cease. Was Samuel Adams a prophet? How many of us were taught in the public school system about the reciprocal duties of kings and subjects in English law? You were. Excellent. You had a teacher. Joe says he might have been. That stimulated a recollection. As children, did we even know Blackstone's commentaries existed? Does history repeat as makeup for missed lessons? Our children trapped in the public school system, are they being taught John Hancock and Samuel Adams were racist pigs who must be canceled from history for their shameful white supremacy? Do repeated requests from the colonists to King George to end the slave trade from which he handsomely profited fit the narrative? Do the colonial statutes of the 13 original colonies and states, requiring that any slaveholder who wished to free a slave must send those slaves, complaining or not, away with a year's worth of support in money and goods, and pay money into a judicial fund to compensate for any crimes the slave might commit, fit the narrative? Did our forefathers go broke freeing their slaves? Thomas Jefferson went broke freeing his. He died penniless. July the 4th, 1826, on the 50th anniversary of the Declaration of Independence. Guess who else died that day? His arch political enemy, whom he defeated to get his first term as president, John Adams. They became close friends later on in life and had a steady correspondence between them. Has God moved in America? On July the 6th, year before the Declaration, July the 6th, 1775, Congress published the, quote, Declaration of the Causes and Necessity of Taking Up Arms, unquote. Let's look at this together. Quote, we have not raised armies with ambitious designs of separating from Great Britain and establishing independent states. We fight not for glory or conquest. We exhibit to mankind the remarkable spectacle of a people attached by unprovoked enemies. 2 days later, July the 8th, 1775, year before the Declaration, the Continental Congress, despite British troops firing on Massachusetts Minutemen in April, vowed to make one more petition to their king and their kindred in England. They pleaded for a restored opportunity to evidence, quote, the sincerity of their professions by every testimony of devotion, becoming the most dutiful subjects and the most affectionate colonists, unquote. History knows this as the Olive Branch Petition. Were the colonists attempting to preserve a government, not overthrow it? The king's stone-cold silence in the face of this impassioned appeal sent the colonies into dark despair. Does this fit the narrative of rebellion? Samuel Adams' impatience tried the patience of his continental colleagues. Adams observed that brothers willing to fire upon you are in no mood to listen to you. Since the end of World War II, two of the most important events in, quote, the history of we the people, unquote, are undergoing systematic elimination. Without the truth of the old books, we cannot find them. The first is King George's speech before Parliament, October 26, 1775. October 26, 1775. The second is Parliament's passage of the Prohibitory Act, December 22nd, 1775. Was Samuel Adams a prophet? King George III's October 26, 1775 speech to Parliament proposed to remove the colonists from his protection and treat them as foreign enemies. Lord North, Prime Minister of Great Britain, carried the King's views forward in Parliament. Parliament passed the Prohibitory Act December 22, 1775, 7 months before July the 4th, 1776, Thomas Walpole, member of Parliament's House of Commons, said of the Act, quote, "It begins with a formal indiscriminate declaration of war against the inhabitants of 13 colonies," unquote. David Hartley, another member of Parliament, said, quote, "An inflexible majority in the Parliament have now declared all America to be an independent hostile state," unquote. Are we facing a similar situation from the current regime in the District of Criminals? Is there anything new under the sun? News of the Parliament's passage of the Prohibitory Act, December 22, 1775, reached the colonies. Samuel Adams said, quote, "The king has thrown us out of his protection," unquote. Samuel Adams' cousin, John Adams, the future second president under the Constitution, said, quote, "It is a compliant dismemberment of the British Empire. It throws 13 colonies out of the royal protection, levels all distinctions, and makes us independent in spite of our supplications and entreaties," unquote. The Continental Congress of 1776, known as the Second Continental Congress, has this in the notes of proceeding, quote, "that the question was not whether by a declaration of independence we should make ourselves what we are not, but whether we should declare a fact which already exists." Did the colonists attempt to preserve a government, not overthrow it? Has history given us the answer to that question? Were the people in power before the Revolutionary War still in power after the cessation of hostilities? It's a yes or no question. Were the people in power before the Revolutionary War still in power after the cessation of hostilities? Do I have to go Pentecostal on you? Can I get an amen? What's the answer?
Yes.
Some revolution. There were no bloodbaths or reigns of terror among the American colonists. The bloodbaths and reigns of terror were committed against civilians by the troops of their former government that declared their American brothers enemies. Our forefathers drove the redcoat troops from American soil. Quote, "Shall a nation be born at once?" Unquote. If you would like to keep these pocket constitutions, please submit $2 in, with the exception of Pastor James and Harrison, Brother Harrison. I owe them. Please open your Constitution booklets to the Unanimous Declaration of the 13 United States of America, page 36. This Continental Congress of 1776 was titled the Second Continental Congress. The Second Continental Congress. On the second line at the top of page 36, we read this, quote, "The history of the present King of Great Britain is a history of repeated injuries and usurpations, all having in direct object the establishment of an absolute tyranny over these states," unquote. Do we see the present regime in the District of Criminals repeating the, quote, "repeated injuries and usurpations," unquote, of King George III? Our forefathers, the 56 signers of the Declaration of Independence, predicted King George would accuse them of treason and hunt them all down like dirty dogs. Why because they published proof of repeated injuries and usurpations, quote unquote, of a reigning king on the world stage. What does it say next? Quote, to prove this, let facts be submitted to a candid world. Unquote. What follows at this point in your Constitution booklets are 27 facts supporting criminal charges against the king destroying the life, liberty, and earnings of his own people. Is there a criminal regime in the District of Criminals in the 2020s committing the same, quote, repeated injuries and usurpations, unquote, of King George III? Look at page 37. On page 37, count five paragraphs up from the bottom of page 37. It begins, quote, for taking away our charters, unquote. Fact 21 of 27 facts submitted to a candid world reads, quote, for taking away our charters, abolishing our most valuable laws, and altering fundamentally the forms of our governments, unquote. Is the regime in the 117th Congress ramming legislation through both houses in the 2020s to take away our, quote, charters of government, unquote? Fact 23. We just read fact 21. For taking away our charters. Fact 23 reads, quote, he has abdicated government here by declaring us out of his protection and waging war against us, unquote. Is an inflexible majority of Congress in the 2020s waging war against the American people? How have we become their enemies? Did God decide, instead of a great awakening, we needed the rude awakening? Does that give us a hint, maybe, what we should be doing? How have we become their enemies? Is it because God wants us to know that we as a people are his enemy? On page 38, fact 27 begins, quote, he has excited domestic insurrections amongst us. Do Democrat mayors and governors excite domestic insurrections among their cities and states? Did a member of Congress, Maxine Waters, excite insurrection against the sitting jury in the Chauvin case? Do corporate donors to the regime in D.C. offer their city stores up for looting and vandalism to raise the prices for law-abiding shoppers? Or is that just some conspiracy theory? We've all had to get new conspiracy theories. All the old ones we had have come true. Fact 27 continues. Quote, and has endeavored to bring on the inhabitants of our frontiers the merciless Indian savages whose known rule of warfare is an undistinguished destruction of all ages, sexes, and conditions, unquote. Is the D.C. regime bringing on the inhabitants below our southern frontier, whose known rule of warfare is the use of women and children to hide the crossing of the border, to wreak an undistinguished destruction upon all ages, sexes, and conditions of Americans? The very next paragraph in your Constitution booklets describes these 27 facts as what? Oppressions. You encourage me. Is there anything new under the sun? who overthrew whom. In the nearly 250 years since the Declaration of Independence, who has successfully refuted these 27 charges against the king? Has anyone even bothered? Turn in your Bibles, for those of you who still have the capacity to read the printed page, your vision is still good enough, I want you to see this from your own Bibles. Isaiah chapter 66, verse number 8. To students of the Scriptures, the end-time prophet Isaiah makes reference here to what is obviously the first resurrection, which Jesus says, John chapter 5, is, quote, the resurrection of life, unquote. Let us recite together out of Isaiah chapter 66, verse 8, or the screen, Isaiah 66, verse number 8. Who hath heard such a thing? Who hath seen such things? Shall the earth be made to bring forth in one day? Or shall a nation be born at once? For as soon as Zion travailed, she brought forth her children. Yet, in light of the history of we the people, it is arresting to read this verse of Scripture. Is it so strange a thing to read a foreshadowing of the fulfillment of a Bible prophecy in the history of God's people? Why is it important to know that King George III declared war on his own subjects in the western part of the British Empire? It has already been done a second time. In the history of we the people, one of our regimes secretly declared us to be the enemy for the second time. Secretly. Did that happen because we forgot the history of the first time? Does history repeat as makeup for missed lessons? On the history of We the People table, I had to locate it in two places. We have a single sheet copy of history resources from which this lesson was prepared. It's free. I want you to have it so you know from where this information came. In Thanksgiving, we remember the late Pastor Gray Clark, who collected a significant part of this research. To be continued, God willing, on another occasion at which we hope to give you that secret history of the second time that we the people were declared to be enemies.